We do not have a quorum, so we won't call the meeting to order, but we have a presentation, actually a couple of presentations, on vaccinations that we're going to have today in committee. We're going to go 45 minutes with our presenter and then 45 minutes with the Department of Health. We agreed bipartisanly to kind of provide a balanced presentation here today, and that's what we're going to accomplish. And then about 2 o'clock, we're going to hear House File 1584, Representative Dean's bill. And then we are done. We will not come back this evening. And I know there's at least a few people who will be pleased about that. So with that, I'm going to invite our first presenter to the testifying table so we can begin. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and then please begin with the presentation.
Teresa Deischer. I am here to share with you some information and data that Sound Choice Pharmaceutical Institute has been working on for the past several years. And Sound Choice is a nonprofit research and education organization dedicated to increasing awareness about the widespread and pervasive use of aborted fetal material in biomedical research and drug production, in cosmetics, and in the food and beverage industry. I obtained my doctorate from Stanford University in molecular and cellular physiology in 1990 and completed my postdoctoral work at the University of Washington. My career has been spent in the commercial biotechnology industry at companies that include Genentech, Repligen, Zymogenetics, Immunex, and Amgen. During my career, I have done work from basic biological and drug discovery through clinical development. I am an inventor on 22 issued U.S. patents, and several clinical trials have resulted from these patents. FGF-18 is currently in phase 1 trials for osteoarthritis and phase 2 trials for cartilage repair. And factor 13 completed phase 2 surgical bleeding clinical trials in February 2011. In January 2011, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee released a strategic plan for autism disorder research, and that's Appendix A. We have copies that you can obtain from Terry Kopp. In this plan, they accept the June 2009 recommendations of the National Vaccine Advisory Committee to support additional studies into the link between vaccines and autism disorders. Autism disorder is a polygenic disease requiring an additional environmental trigger or triggers. A polygenic disease is a disease for which multiple diverse genes may be involved. However, no single gene is either necessary nor sufficient to induce the disease.
Dr. Deischer, I'm going to interrupt you momentarily. We now have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. I was asking my able assistant here if we had minutes yet, and I think that's probably asking just a little much at this point. But Dr. Deischer, please continue. Thank you.
In the case of autism disorders, over 300 genes have been associated with the disease. Additional environmental or health insults are required to trigger this disease in genetically susceptible individuals. What this means, the term polygenic, is that having a mutation in one of the genes associated with a polygenic disease does not mean a person will develop the disease. Some additional insult is what triggers the disease. For instance, in animals, we know that Crohn's-like disease requires a genetic mutation, an intestinal bacterial anomaly, and a viral infection in order to be triggered. In the IACC 2011 strategic plan from the Department of Health and Human Services, the fact that spontaneous de novo genetic mutations are associated with autism disorders in at least 10% of the cases is discussed. That's on page 33 from the PDF pagination and page 25 from the IACC pagination. What this means is that some mutations that have been associated with autism are not present in the parents and therefore have occurred only recently in the children. Some of these de novo mutations are present in genes that code for proteins that are critical for nerve cell communication, which is also called synaptic connectivity. The IACC strategic plan states that progress in identifying environmental factors that increase autism risk has been made recently, although this area of research has received less scientific attention and far fewer research dollars than genetic risk factors. Environmental factors may be pertinent not only to brain development, but also to chronic systemic features of at least some groups of ASD, autism spectrum disorders. The strategic plan goes on to state on page 35 that recent studies suggest that factors such as parental age and exposure to infections, toxins, and other biological agents may confer environmental risk. These findings require further investigation and testing. How would such investigation and testing be done? Analysis of autism disorder rates using what is called hockey stick analysis, published in March 2010 by the Environmental Protection Agency, has identified what is called a change point in U.S. and worldwide autism rates. Their change point analysis, as well as Sound Choice's independent change point analysis, consider autism prevalence for birth years. What this means is that a change point in, say, 1988 is not a year when autism diagnosis suddenly increases. It is the year that children subsequently diagnosed with autism disorder were born. This is important to remember because other statistics relevant to the topic we are discussing today are not given for birth year cohorts, but for the actual year of measure. Another important point to keep in mind is that the EPA and Sound Choice's change point analysis considered only autism disorder and not autism spectrum. Autism disorder is the more severe form of autism and is diagnosed prior to the age of 3. From the data sets that the EPA analyzed, a change point occurs in birth year 1988. What this means is that autism was rising at a lower rate in children born prior to 1988 than in children born after 1988. Analyses such as these have been used to detect ecosystem response to environmental toxins, and resulting estimated thresholds have been used as the basis for setting U.S. environmental policy. Therefore, this type of change point data is robust enough to set federal policy. The EPA publication recommends on page 4 that future studies should examine for novel or increasing exposures to environmental factors from gestation to at least age 3 for our calculated 1988 to 1989 birth cohorts. For potential in utero exposures, then, we would be looking for something widely, almost universally introduced to pregnant mothers in the years 1987 through Q1 1989. For a childhood vaccine, for instance, recommended to be given between 12 and 15 months of age, with up to 20% immunized before 12 months, and up to another 33% immunized between 15 and 36 months, we would be looking for an event between 1988 and 1991.4. The method used by the EPA for change point analysis, called hockey stick analysis, can identify only a single change point in a data set. More sophisticated analysis methods, called segmented line fit algorithms, are able to identify multiple change points in data sets. Sound Choice has analyzed the data sets used by the EPA, employing this more sophisticated segmented line algorithm, as well as additional data sets of U.S. autism disorder, and we have confirmed the 1988 EPA change point and furthermore identified two additional U.S. change points, one in 1981 and the third in 1996. Taken together, the work at Sound Choice and the EPA publication established three U.S. change points for autism disorder: 1981, 1988, and 1996. These data indicate that some widespread, perhaps almost universal exposure or environmental trigger was introduced that would affect children born in and after 1981, 1988, and 1996. The IACC strategic plan states that biological agents may confer environmental risk. What is a biological agent? I'd like to quote from the FDA's website to give you the definition of a biological agent. Biological products include a wide range of products such as vaccines, blood and blood components, allergenics, somatic cells, gene therapy, DNA, tissues, and recombinant therapeutic proteins. There are those who may tell you that the vaccine autism question has been answered and debunked. However, not only is the U.S. Health and Human Services IACC strategic plan calling for further investigation of the link between vaccines and autism, but they are also calling for investigation of biological agents contaminating the vaccines that we inject into our children. What are these biological agents? I want to say only one thing about thimerosal, which is mercury in vaccines, and I am not saying that thimerosal is innocuous. However, there were higher levels of thimerosal in total childhood vaccinations from 1948 to 1988 than there are today. And furthermore, change points in thimerosal levels in vaccines do not coincide with autism disorder change points. And the levels of mercury today are greatly reduced compared to 1999. However, autism disorder has continued to rise. The viruses used in vaccines are produced in cell lines because production in a test tube is inefficient and too costly. Currently, both animal and human fetal cell lines are used by vaccine manufacturers. Production of viruses in cell lines results in residual DNA and cellular debris from the manufacturing cell line in the final product. For instance, as can be found in Merck's summary basis for approval, which is Appendix F, page 3, for the chickenpox vaccine, over 2 micrograms of residual double-stranded human fetal DNA are present in each vaccine, which is approximately twice the amount of the active ingredient of the vaccine, which is the varicella virus, a DNA virus. As FDA scientists state in their 2008 publication in the journal Biologicals, the danger of residual DNA in vaccines has been debated for over 50 years without appropriate studies. The 2008 publication by these FDA scientists demonstrates the real and present danger of human DNA residuals in vaccines, which include cancer, autoimmunity, and genomic disruption. As I have already mentioned, the IACC strategic plan well summarizes data demonstrating de novo genomic disruptions at varied sites in at least 10% of children diagnosed with ASD. Sound Choice became interested in the potential link between vaccines and autism because we were approached and asked to develop alternative vaccines for parents who objected to the use of human fetal cells for vaccine production. In the U.S., over 10 vaccines are manufactured using human fetal cell lines, and for MMR2 and hepatitis A, there are not alternatives available in the U.S. The vaccine for chickenpox is also produced using a human fetal cell line, and the only alternative anywhere in the world, which some data indicates may be the preferred alternative, is natural exposure. Based on the research we have done, perhaps as many as 3% of parents decline vaccines, primarily due to the use of human fetal cells in the manufacturing. The viruses for the chickenpox and the hepatitis A vaccines are manufactured in the MRC5 cell line, which was derived from a normal 3.5-month male fetus, while the rubella virus in the MMR2 vaccine is manufactured in the WI38 cell line, which was derived from a normal 3-month female fetus. In taking on the mission to provide alternative vaccines to those who object to the use of human fetal cell lines for vaccine production on a moral basis, we began to study the literature surrounding vaccines. The vaccine autism controversy is difficult to miss, and simply reading the published literature should immediately arouse curiosity in a fresh and objective perspective mind. Firstly, even in the publications that claim no link between MMR and autism. There is an evident autism change point in 1988. The authors dismissed the link between autism and the MMR vaccine in these publications because, as they point out, vaccine compliance was already well over 95% in the UK before 1988. However, what the authors documented on page 4, the top right, which is Appendix L of our binders, but failed to investigate, was that the MMR vaccine used in the UK was switched in 1988 and 1989. Prior to 1988, the MMR in the UK was produced in animal cell lines, and in 1988 and 1989, three new MMRs replaced that original MMR, all of which use human fetal cell lines for the production of at least one of the viruses contained in the MMR. Having worked in commercial biotechnology and clinical development programs, I was aware of the residuals that would be found in vaccines, and having also worked with homologous recombination and molecular biology, I was also aware that the human fetal DNA introduced in vaccines has the potential to elicit autoimmune responses or to incorporate into the recipient's own genes and disrupt normal protein production. Inflection points, change points, are clear by eye in U.S. autism prevalence data from the Department of Education, as well as from the California Department of Developmental Services. This intriguing and perplexing visual assessment of U.S. autism prevalence, together with publications on autism rates in the UK, led Sound Choice to more fully investigate. What we have found is that across continents and across decades, changes in autism disorder, not considering autism spectrum, but only autism disorder, are clearly associated with the introduction of vaccines produced using human fetal cell lines. Each time we inject our children with one of these vaccines, we are also injecting them with residual fetal human DNA. U.S. vaccination compliance information was collected by the U.S. Immunization Surveillance from 1959 through 1985, which was a telephone interview system. Then by the National Health Interview Survey, NHIS, from 1991 to the present, and by the National Immunization Survey, NIS, from 1994 to the present. No data was collected for 1986 through 1991, except by retrospective studies after measles outbreaks had occurred. The CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reports contain data regarding measles immunization coverage that can be used to fill in this 1986 through 1991 gap. I've already mentioned that the UK 1988 birth year change point in autism disorder is associated with the switch from animal to human fetal produced MMR. In the US, the switch was first approved in late 1979, and by 1983, only the human fetal produced MMR2 was available in the US, coinciding with the 1981 birth year change point for autism. In 1989, a second dose of MMR was added to the U.S. vaccination recommendations to be given not less than 28 days after the first dose. We cannot determine the significance of this second dose without accessing each child's immunization record, because while it is geared towards 4 to 6-year-olds, the recommendation allows it 28 days after the first dose. And we know that significant numbers of children, up to 20%, receive vaccinations earlier than recommended. More significantly, a vaccine compliance campaign was undertaken after measles outbreaks in 1988 and 1989 that brought compliance with MMR from as low as 49%, and perhaps even lower between 1986 and 1989 birth years, to over 82% in 1991, which would be birth year 1989. Introduction of a second recommended dose in 1989 and the compliance campaign correlate with the 1988 calculated autism disorder birth year change point in the United States. MMR vaccination rates increased from birth years 1987 to 1989 by at least 20% and perhaps by as much as 30 to 40%. In 1995, the chickenpox vaccine was approved in the U.S. and correlates with the 1995.6 autism birth disorder birth year change point. The rate of chickenpox uptake corresponds to the post-1995.6 birth year change point slopes. Not included in my written testimony, but something that I want to add orally, is also the fact that within the past 5 years, in our combination polio vaccines that we are given to children at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months of age, a significant proportion of our children at those early months of life are also receiving from the poliovax contained in those combination vaccines, human fetal DNA. And this may be why the apparent earlier year of autism onset that we're seeing in the past few years. Similar associations between autism disorder change points and human fetal DNA containing vaccines are evident for Canada, Denmark, Japan, and several Southeast Asian countries. The U.S. Vaccine Safety Database contains data regarding immunizations in autism disorder for hundreds of thousands of children, and careful analysis of this data comparing autism rates prior to 1995 and after 1995, as well as comparing autism disorder prevalence in children vaccinated or not vaccinated with the chickenpox vaccine, will provide significant information about the potential association between the use of human fetal cells for vaccine production and autism prevalence. Sound Choice is preparing a proposal to gain access to the Vaccine Safety Database to conduct this analysis. We are partially funded through a grant from the Murdoch Charitable Trust, and we are actively looking for additional funding to conduct these types of studies. I also need to say that it is important that independent groups conduct these types of analysis, and several groups should independently examine each question so that children are finally helped and protected. One of the key scientists funded by the CDC to do studies into MMR and autism links, studies used to dismiss the MMR autism hypothesis, was indicted on April 13th this year, 2011, on 13 counts of fraud and 9 counts of money laundering. Furthermore, Dr. Thorson had already been cited for academic misconduct by his own university and was charged with embezzling $1 million grant from the Centers for Disease Control. There are also viral contaminants from the human fetal cell lines used to produce the vaccines present in the final product. Human endogenous retrovirus K is present in the MMR2, in Mirovax, which is a monovalent rubella no longer produced, and the chickenpox vaccines. This work was published in the Journal of Virology in 2010. HERV-K, human endogenous retrovirus K, is a virus related to the MMLV virus, a virus that was used to deliver gene therapy in clinical trials for boys with SCID disease, that's severe combined immune deficiency. They're also known as the Bubble Boys. The MMLV virus caused inappropriate gene insertion and subsequent somatic gene mutations in 4 of 9 boys that led to the development of cancer. Although experts testifying prior to the initiation of those clinical trials estimated the risk at 10 to the minus 26, the actual risk turned out to be 4 of 9 boys developed cancer. These studies are published and are included in the appendix of the binders that I have with me. So not only was human fetal DNA introduced to our children with the MMR2 and chickenpox vaccines, but a retrovirus capable of enhancing genomic insertion was also introduced in these vaccines. Sound Choice is focusing our work on quantifying the genomic integration of human DNA fragments into human recipient cells and on epidemiologic studies to evaluate the temporal link between human fetal cell-produced vaccines and worldwide autism prevalence. Additional safety questions about the use of human cell lines for vaccine production include viral contaminants such as the HERV-K. There are clearly several safety issues with our current vaccination program that have not yet but need to be addressed, which may also include the number of vaccinations delivered to children over short time periods. Most importantly, solutions are readily available. Merck has monovalent animal-produced mumps and measles vaccines that could be reactivated within a few months. And Japan has several animal-produced MMR vaccines with outstanding safety and efficacy records that could be brought to the U.S. rapidly. The monovalent measles vaccine was discontinued by Merck for economic reasons in December of 2008. That makes me ask, what will we now do for pregnant women in the event of another measles outbreak? They should not be given the MMR2, as the rubella virus in that vaccine crosses the placenta and can infect the fetus, potentially leading to congenital rubella anomalies. This is just another example of where vaccine policy has not been based on the best interests of the patient. The vaccine autism issue evokes strong emotional responses from people, and the use of human fetal cell lines for vaccine production may stir up pro-choice defenses. However, this issue is not about Andrew Wakefield, whom I've never met, or about women's reproductive rights. In fact, most pro-choice women, and most of my personal friends are pro-choice, are philosophically opposed to injecting their children with vaccines containing human fetal cell DNA. This issue is about the health of our children and what we give them in vaccines. And politics has no place when we think about the health of our children and a devastating disease like autism. I would like to close with a quote from a father of two boys with autism, written to the Stanford Alumni Magazine. Policymakers and medical professionals ought to be more motivated by a true desire to know more rather than ideology. As a parent, I don't care about ideology. I just need research to help me choose between therapies that work and those that don't. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Dr. Deischer. Members will take, we have about 15 minutes for questions for Dr. Deischer, and then we have another presenter to start at about 1:15. So with that, members, questions, comments, discussion? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Deischer, for coming here today and giving us this good information. I, quite frankly, had no idea myself all the things that happen with immunizations we give. Can you just tell me how long, and I came in late, so you probably already mentioned this, how long have you been working on this issue?
About 3 years.
3 years, okay. And then can you just give us a background? I don't know what happens when we create
Vaccines,
thank you. Long night last night.
So
what is the process for testing and for understanding these issues before these vaccines are approved, if there are any?
Dr. Deischer.
Thank you. There have been no studies on the residual human DNA in these vaccines that have been done that address all of these issues to date. So the first publications looking at any of these questions came out in 2008, and those were from FDA scientists. And they're concerned about the danger of cancer induction using these cells. And what their concern is, so when we make the viruses that we use in the vaccine, so the active ingredient of the vaccine is a virus that elicits an immune response from the recipient and then would give you immunity if you were to be subsequently exposed to naturally occurring virus, okay? We have to make these viruses in cell lines because they're too large to make in a test tube. So we make them in animal cell lines, we make them in human fetal cell lines, and people are developing methods to make these in plant cells now. And in that process, when you go to harvest the virus, you carry components of the producing cell line through to your final product. You cannot eliminate those. And for instance, in the chickenpox vaccine, 2 micrograms of double-stranded DNA is present in the viral in the final product. That is from Merck's measuring of the residual DNA levels, not from our measuring, and those numbers are contained in their summary basis for approval. Recommendations originally were that no more than 100 picograms of residual DNA be present in each vaccine, and those recommendations have been relaxed twice. Now it's at 10 nanograms because the manufacturers could not meet those. So here we have chickenpox, which is 2 micrograms. That's 200-fold higher even than those relaxed recommendations. So because the FDA knows that the presence of this gene poses a danger for genomic insertion, and they were worried about cancer. So what they thought is a cancer-causing gene would come all the way through the manufacturing process and be inserted and cause cancer. They recommended that what the manufacturers do is chop up the residual DNA in the vaccines so that it's about 250 nucleotides long, or DNA is made up of nucleotides, because the smallest known gene is 800 nucleotides. And so their reasoning probably was, well, if we chop it up to 250 nucleotides, we don't have a whole gene. So then we don't need to worry about a cancer gene being inserted and the cancer protein being made. When they made those recommendations, we didn't have the molecular biology information that we have now, but we know, and we know this primarily from scientists trying to do gene therapy, that those large fragments don't insert into the genome anyway. And it turns out that fragments about 250 base pairs and below, actually 500 base pairs, 500 nucleotides and below, more readily insert into the recipient's genome. And there's a large body of scientific literature published on this. So in trying to prevent the danger of a cancer gene, the recommendations have actually inadvertently created probably the most dangerous scenario. Now, the levels in Merck's vaccine are so high that they did do additional safety studies, and those are contained in their summary basis for approval. However, they did not do the correct safety studies, because they looked at genomic insertion of this human DNA in mice. And genomic insertion is species specific. They needed to look at this insertion in human cell lines. So the appropriate studies have never been done.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, this is fascinating and I think compelling. And there's a list, there's a panel of people coming at this. I presume they'll be reacting to this, and if they're not, I hope they do. Doctor, what have been, has the people embraced this idea, and are they moving away from this now and making the world safer? Do they believe you? How's that going?
Dr. Deischer.
So I've actually found the response interesting, and I find the greatest opposition to this tending to come when I speak to groups of physicians who are affiliated with religious organizations. And when I present this data to organizations that are completely secular, like the Washington State Medical Association, they object, I think, to the potential pro-life components of it. But the scientists and physicians are well aware of the potential danger. And some of them speak about the rise in really unexplained leukemias and lymphomas in children that they're seeing, and, you know, are very supportive of this, that research needs to be done, because they know the potential dangers.
Well, Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, I'm just, I mean, has anybody, like, embraced this and changed something that they didn't do before?
Dr. Dyson.
Like Minnesota, we pay for this stuff. It turns out that we're poisoning or creating more autistic children. Somalis are 1 in 25. They come here. They were fine before they visited us and made this state their home. Seems like we have a lot of responsibility. Is anybody taking this seriously besides just letting you talk to groups? And, like, is the Department of Health coming down? I mean, this is, you know, really big news, it seems to me, and this is something that should be, like, on Channel 5 or something.
Dr. Deischer.
I believe CBS recently covered this potential link in a news story that went out. And we obviously take it seriously, and we're dedicated to providing alternatives. It's interesting, you know, we go out to third world countries, we go down to Central and South America with the best intentions, humanitarian intentions, to provide these immunizations. And in 2000 and 2001, the World Health Organization had a massive measles, MMR, immunization campaign in Southeast Asia. And these countries previously did not have autism, and now they do. So our humanitarian efforts, you know, may have unintended consequences, and that's certainly not something that anyone would want to do, introduce a novel disease in our efforts to actually improve the lives of these children.
Okay, members, we have three more folks on the list with questions and about 7 minutes, so just keep that in mind. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Dreischer, what about transfusions? And the DNA that we receive from transfusions. Could you explain?
So the
Dr. Dreischer.
Sorry, I'm not great with protocol yet. The fact that we have blood transfusions was used by people like Dr. Paul Offit to just dismiss the dangers of this. And it's important to remember that the DNA will be more or less dangerous depending on the cell type and the age of the cell that it's presented to. So, for instance, if you had genomic incorporation in a mature cell that had a limited lifetime, for instance, our skin cells, they're sloughing off all the time, probably there would not be any consequences. If you had genomic insertion into a stem cell, which is what happened in those gene therapy trials in the SCID patients, then you have the danger and you have the resulting cancer. Okay, so here we're giving DNA to young children with rapidly developing brains, right? Now, if you want to look at, whereas if we were to give these to adults or older children, the potential health consequences are probably less likely to occur unless the DNA was to get into a stem cell. So if you go back then and you say, well, what about young children who receive transfusions? Is that associated with autism? So first of all, not many children receive transfusions. And when young children receive transfusions, they tend to receive packed platelets, not the whole blood components. Platelets do not have nuclei. They're enucleated, and so they do not present the nuclear DNA to these children. So we don't have any information in children about how transfusions would impact them, because they don't get them.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I've been following it over the last few years. I have some four grandchildren, and I know from the perspective of the vaccine and following that it's gotten some pretty disparaging news, you know, regarding falsification of data and prior. I'm still very compelled to keep a watch on it. I think there is some evidence that we need to study more. It's more of a policy rather than a medical. And listening to your testimony and reading it as you were reading it, I guess I was reading in the script that there's an animal produced vaccine line in Japan. And for us, I think this is a follow up with Representative Abler, isn't there enough compelling evidence to at least to have us modify for it on a temporary basis until this can all be validated, that maybe we shouldn't be moving? Wouldn't it be prudent? Representative Abler brought up 1 in 25. I think in your paper here it's 1 in 28 in terms of our Somali population, or I found it online as you were speaking, that at least in a certain population until we can, I mean, in your estimation as a policymaker, shouldn't we be moving to a less dangerous line of vaccines?
Dr. Dreischer.
So the type of change point analysis that the EPA did and that Sound Choice has done, and we've submitted our analysis for peer-reviewed publication, it's under review right now, it has been sufficient to set U.S. environmental policy. And this should be sufficient for us to take a close look at vaccines and make some changes. Now, in response to the distrust of mercury in vaccines, that was removed from the hepatitis B vaccine, really with less, let's say, robust, compelling statistical evidence. And I'm not trying to say that mercury is innocuous. I really don't want that in my vaccines. Than we have with this link, right? And I think when people, we discuss and debate all the time, how widespread do you make this information known? There isn't currently an alternative vaccine in the U.S. because Merck ceased production of the monovalent measles and mumps, right? So how should you inform people when you don't yet have an alternative? And we're working very hard to bring in an alternative. I think if people know about this and think about the health of our children and how devastating a disease autism is, many people like to dismiss it. And they'll say, well, Bill Gates has autism. Well, Bill Gates doesn't have autism. So they dismiss the devastating effects of autism on these families. And if people just said no, Merck would be producing the alternatives within several months. Right? We have to make decisions, and then we'll find that the alternatives will be available.
Thank you. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Dreischer. One of the things that I've found interesting is the access and the importance of data and reporting for your research. And one of the things that was discussed was the high prevalence of autism among our Somali community. We've been having a debate about racial disparities reporting, and do you think it's important for us to try to gather data and to have access to that information when we're trying to make public policy decisions on the healthcare front?
Dr. Dreischer.
Do I think that data regarding racial disparities is important in public policy decisions?
Representative Hosh.
Madam Chair, that or just data reporting overall. For us to make informed decisions and to be able to conduct research, we need to have access to that. And as policymakers, that is something we're constantly debating and struggling over. So I just wanted to understand the importance and how you access that data, and also on the components if that there are actual racial disparities when it comes to health outcomes.
Dr. Dreischer.
So in regard to the autism work, we would look at that data through genomic efforts and sequencing efforts. And I believe one hypothesis would be that the Somali population has a SNP, it's called a single nucleotide polymorphism, or some other genetic anomaly in that population which makes them more susceptible to whatever triggers autism. And sequencing of the genome would look into that and compare the different races. I do know from a broad healthcare perspective that different racial and ethnic backgrounds oftentimes respond differently to drugs. And so if we're going to adequately treat and give appropriate medical care to everyone in the U.S., we need to consider racial disparities when we're doing our clinical trials, right? Because one group, I don't know, Chinese, may respond better to this beta blocker than to that beta blocker. And we know that beta blockers have some racial disparities in the outcome. So I think it's very important.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, Dr. Dreischer, you might have partly answered this. I was going to ask you about whether any of your work has been published and peer-reviewed, because I have somewhat of a public health background, and I know that oftentimes in health issues, you know, things that we sort of do have fads in health sometimes, and things kind of come and go in the media, and our sort of our gold standard is publishing and having peer review. And after a while, you know, sometimes even things sometimes that a lot of people agree on then can be found to be different. But I just wanted you to talk a little bit about if you have published and where.
So we
Dr. Dreischer.
We have presented our work at the International Meeting for Autism Research in 2010, and those are poster presentations. We've just submitted our change point analysis for peer review publication, and it's under review. Our grant applications are peer reviewed. And I think most importantly, the evidence that I'm presenting to you today is not predominantly my evidence or my work. This is published evidence from the EPA, from the FDA, from academic scientists publishing in the Journal of Virology. And if you look at the 2011 Health and Human Services Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee's strategic plan, you'll see a long list of these publications, peer-reviewed published publications, documenting de novo genomic insertions in autism patients.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Deischer. You know, I don't doubt that a lot of the pieces of information that you're drawing from are peer-reviewed and published in various places, but I think that you're presenting something here which is rather novel and different from, you know, that's we've seen before. Bringing it together requires, and the way you bring it together also requires peer review. I'm sure you would agree with that. And so you said that you've submitted this change point analysis, but you didn't say where you've submitted it, and I'd be curious to know that.
Dr. Deischer.
It's been submitted to Autism Research.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome, Doctor. You're a scientist. We're policymakers. We make decisions in a noisy and public and boisterous way, and we wrestle with difficult decisions. I think the public would probably not give us great marks necessarily for how we make decisions, but we make them. We're wrestling right now with a budget, having a difficult time with that. We hear from people all the time. People come and testify about information, about the impact of our potential decisions on their lives, and we try and take that information and make a good decision. You're presenting to us information that is very complex in a scientific way. It's the first hearing that we've had on this. This session, and the first exposure we had to this information. And so as a citizen and not as a scientist, I'm wondering, and I'm going to ask the other people who come up to talk about this the same question, as a citizen and not as a scientist, what advice do you have for us in terms of making a decision based on the testimony that you're providing for us today?
Dr. Deischer.
Because of the public's perceived fears about the link between vaccines and autism, which nothing that Dr. Offit or Merck or the CDC has been able to do to allay, more and more people are refusing vaccinations. So this is a public health issue, right, as well as a potential national security issue. The solution is very simple. Investigate objectively and fully the vaccines and the autism link and provide alternatives that people will readily use. Mercury has been taken out of many vaccines. We can keep mercury out of other vaccines if that continues to be a perceived issue. We can manufacture vaccines using animal cell lines. All we have to do is insist that the pharmaceutical companies provide safe vaccines. Now, in the U.S., it's interesting. The pharmaceutical companies have no liability for the safety of their vaccines.
Madam Chair. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Dr. Deischler. I don't think that you really answered my question, and maybe it's a hard question for you to answer as a citizen. And I understand that you're suggesting that we should make vaccines safe, but we don't have the capacity to do the investigation that you're describing as state legislators, as state policymakers. That is the work of America's scientists. And so when you bring to us a piece of information like this, it's the first that we've seen it. It's complex. I have a background in nursing. There is someone who has a doctorate in science on this committee, but most of us don't have a lot of background in science. So as a citizen, I am wondering if you think that we should take this information today and make public policy decisions based on this one and single hearing. Wouldn't this be a decision, wouldn't this discussion be better in a scientific forum with people with scientific backgrounds like you to render a conclusion about the data before you bring it to a public policy arena and ask us to make a decision on something that is such an important public health question for the people of Minnesota.
Dr. Deischer.
I did not come here to ask you to make a public policy decision about this. I was asked as a scientist to come here to present the scientific data to the committee as these issues are grappled with. Okay, so I am not here myself to introduce legislation or to ask you to make public policy. I am here to inform you. That's what I was invited here to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Deischler, I appreciate that. I appreciate that we both understand that you're here to present to us a perspective, but not to advocate for public policy at this time. Thank you.
Okay, members, at this point, we're going to move on to our next testifier. Dr. Deischer will still be here if there are follow-up questions after the next presenter, but we have about 45 minutes for the next presenter, so if you could approach the table. And I believe there's three that will be testifying. If you all want to approach the table, you can do that. But we will need to wrap up this portion at about 2:05. So however the three of you want to divide up that time. If you could introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed.
Sure. My name is Chris Ayersman, and I'm the Director for Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention, and Control at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm also on the 15-member Federal Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices that makes national immunization recommendations, and I am the parent of a child on the autism spectrum. And I've been asked to give the department's perspective on the issues raised by Dr. Deischer regarding vaccines produced using human cell lines. Dr. Deischer has presented a theory that raises concerns about vaccine safety. We at the Department of Health are very interested in vaccine safety. Public health nurses visit clinics all over the state, giving trainings on immunization, and one thing they stress is the importance of reporting anything that looks like it might be a side effect from a vaccine. We also teach the importance of giving out a copy of the federal vaccine information statement with every vaccine that's given, so that the patient or parent knows what kind of side effects might occur and what to do if that happens. However, we have concerns about Dr. Deischer's theory that vaccines cause autism because of the research that's been done in this area over the last 15 years. A great deal of Dr. Deischer's points are based on an ecologic observation. In other words, looking at how autism is occurring in the population. And that's an ecologic study is a very, very important part of generating hypotheses. And that's what Dr. Deischer has done. And her comments and perspective is very dependent on the change point analysis that she described. But it's very important to take an ecologic study beyond that level, take it to the next point. And I think the concern that we have is this viewpoint or this theory has not moved beyond theory and has not moved to the point of causation. And as we heard, has not yet been published in the peer-reviewed literature. I'll also just make a couple points on her change point analysis comments, just to remind you that the booster MMR dose that we talked about is routinely given at 4 to 6 years of age, a preschool vaccine. And although when we talk about minimum intervals, if a child is behind on vaccination, or in the case of our current outbreak, we will say you can give that second dose at least 28 days after the first dose, so that minimum interval, that's not actually the time that the vaccine is recommended. So I just want to clarify that. And then I also want to comment on the licensure of the varicella vaccine in 1995. Unfortunately, we had very poor uptake of that vaccine right after it was licensed, and had to work very hard over subsequent years to increase vaccine coverage levels. And so that was not a vaccine for which we had immediate uptake. So just those comments on the ecologic study and change point analysis. So when we're talking about these vaccines that have been grown in human diploid cells, I want to acknowledge that rubella is one of them. And the rubella vaccine is now given as part of the MMR vaccine, as you heard. And as you heard today, too, the MMR vaccine has been the focus of vaccine concerns. An English physician, Andrew Wakefield, suggested in an article in the Lancet Medical Journal and in accompanying media coverage that MMR could cause autism. And this set off a panic in England and eventually the United States, with many parents rejecting the MMR vaccine. Public health authorities around the world launched studies to provide definitive answers that would resolve the issue, and more than 25 large population studies were eventually conducted. And I think it's important to comment in relation to Dr. Deischer's testimony that those were conducted in multiple countries. So although Dr. Wakefield was from the UK and there were some studies that were done in the UK, the experience of the United Kingdom was not the only country that was looked at in those multiple studies. And none of them found a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. And this is relevant to the issue that we're talking about today, because MMR contains rubella, and therefore if there was a relationship between the rubella vaccine or these vaccine and becoming autistic, it should have shown up in these large population studies. Because one of the things that's important is if you look at, as I said, an ecologic study, that's looking at what are we seeing when we just look at trends, you know, when we look at fluoride in the water and communities that have natural fluoride, we saw less dental caries, and therefore we looked into that more, and there were recommendations made. When we look at an ecologic study, we see a trend and we look into it more closely. But when we get to a population study, we're actually looking at, well, how does that relationship affect people? And that's really what we care about. And so those studies didn't find that association. And I won't get into the genetic issues. We have two experts from the university who are here to do that. But let me just say that while we at the department appreciate and share Dr. Deischer's interest in making sure that vaccines are safe, we know from experience that any expression of doubt can scare parents out of vaccinating their children against diseases that are real, present, and potentially lethal. We can see this happening at our doorstep. In Minnesota right now, we are experiencing the largest outbreak of measles since 1995. And with just one more case, it'll be the largest outbreak since 1990. We currently have 23 confirmed cases of measles, 14 of which have been hospitalized. That's an over 60% hospitalization rate. The number of parents whose children caught measles in the last few weeks said that they chose not to let them get the MMR vaccine because they were worried that it might cause autism, an idea put forth by Dr. Wakefield a decade ago. Since he proposed his theory, the research behind his claims has been debunked, and Dr. Wakefield himself has been stripped of his license to practice medicine because of the fraudulent and unethical nature of his work. However, none of this silences that little voice in the back of a parent's head that whispers, "But what if this really isn't safe?" The fear of MMR causing autism is so strong that after all these years, it is still putting kids in the hospital with measles. Dr. Deischer is operating a commercial venture to produce a new version of vaccines. The department would welcome additional vaccine manufacturers to the market. Having more manufacturers would reduce the possibility of vaccine shortages, and to the extent that parents want to avoid vaccines produced by human cell lines, they would be able to do so. If a new vaccine was FDA licensed, we would be very happy to let healthcare providers and the public know about them. However, to suggest right now, without firm data and a proven alternative at hand, that there is something undesirable about current vaccines is to suggest that parents let their children take their chances with measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, or hepatitis. I understand that Dr. Deischer has concerns about the moral implications of human cell-derived vaccines. To make vaccines against rubella or varicella, chickenpox, we need to grow the viruses in live cells and then weaken them so they aren't strong enough to actually cause illness. Other vaccines against viruses are grown in different types of cells, such as monkey kidney cells or chick embryo cells, but the rubella and varicella vaccines are grown in human cells. All of the cells used for this purpose are laboratory-grown descendants of two lung tissue samples, one taken in 1961 and 1966. these cell lines can be maintained indefinitely. There is no ongoing need, nor do we expect one to arise in the future to take new samples that would establish new cell lines. What goes into a vaccine is only the viral material, not the cells in which the viruses are grown. So there is no fetal tissue in vaccines, as has been stated. The National Catholic Bioethics Center recognized this when it stated, quote, vaccine use does not contribute directly to the practice of abortion, since the reasons for having an abortion are not related to vaccine preparation, unquote. The Bioethics Center has also said that when there is no vaccine available that was not produced using fetal cell lines, quote, one is morally free to use the vaccine regardless of its historical association with abortion. The reason is that the risk to public health if one chooses not to vaccinate outweighs the legitimate concern about the origins of the vaccine. This is especially important for parents who have a moral obligation to protect the life and health of their children and those around them, unquote. Legislators are also in a position to protect children's lives and health, and everyone in this room wants to avoid both vaccine-preventable diseases and the possibility of vaccine side effects. So let me just close by saying that it's the department's view that there is not scientific evidence linking MMR vaccines to autism, that that the vaccines available, are limited. We don't have other options, and at least one religious organization, the Catholic Church, has said that individuals are morally free to use vaccines regardless of how they were originally developed. And finally, if Dr. Deischer's company does develop vaccines that are FDA licensed, we would be happy to make providers and the public aware of the alternatives. But we feel that until there is an alternative to protecting children and adults against vaccine-preventable diseases, unproven theories like this one can cause undue fear and result in untoward consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go next, and we'll take about 20 more minutes if it's needed for presentation and then move to questions. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay, I'm Brian Van Ness. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a director of the Institute of Human Genetics and the Division of Medical Genomics. Despite the fact that I don't have any particular specific genetic research interest in autism per se, I do have a vested interest in understanding autism because I also live with a stepson who has autism, so I do understand the daily life, and I have a very vested interest in understanding causes and opportunities to prevent autism. I don't want to discuss any of the moral issues related to the fetal issues because that's not an area of expertise, probably one of more of opinion. But I do want to address some of the scientific concerns. And I first want to say that Dr. Deischer certainly has a credentialed career. She has been accomplished. She has been productive. And I congratulate her for moving science into translational practice. I don't think there's any reason at all to question her credentials or her sincerity in asking the questions that she's asking. I also agree with her at the end of her presentation and in the discussion that for now, the things that she is proposing as concerns have no basis of firm conclusions, and as a result of those lack of firm conclusions, as she agreed, there's probably no indication to change public policy based on concerns without any real conclusions. We in genetics frequently work on probability issues. What is the probability of an event happening based on genetic inheritance, based on the opportunity for mutations? I also agree with Dr. Deischer that autism and the autism spectrum disorder is a complex genetic disease that likely represents a multitude of genetic events that are being deregulated potentially in brain development, and a multitude of environmental exposures that may trigger the susceptibility into autism. For that reason, I think one also then wants to look at the probability that these kinds of events can take place as a result of small contaminating amounts of human DNA in a vaccine. Let me make an analogy here. The analogy is that we know that there are asteroids out there that have the chance of blasting our planet. We don't seem to be too worried about it because it seems to be an improbable event. But we know about it because we have telescopes that can amplify our vision of the heavens to the point where we can actually see them. But it requires enormous amounts of magnification. Likewise, when you look at these vaccines, you have to apply molecular techniques that amplify millions of fold the amount of DNA that's in there so that you can even see it or detect it. So I would argue on the first pass that the amount of DNA and the amount of intact DNA is remarkably small in these kinds of vaccines. As Dr. Deischer pointed out, these vaccines often contain fragments of DNA, which means that the functional components of DNA is lost as it is being fragmented. She points out the fact that retroviral DNA has been shown to be inserted into individuals getting gene therapy and causing cancer. True. However, these are intact retroviral vectors that have been designed to increase their capacity for integrating into the DNA. Not at all available and not a component of the DNA fragments that are present in the vaccine. In addition, one might argue that in order to have an impact, this DNA would have to integrate into the right cells, into the right positions, into the right genes, and in sufficient numbers to affect sufficient number of brain cells, if you will, to impact the cause of autism. These are all not zero probability events, but in sum and in total, highly improbable events. That is, the likelihood that a vaccine DNA fragment is going to travel to the appropriate cells, potentially brain cells, despite the fact that there's a blood-brain barrier, and get into the right cells and infect those cells, integrate into the DNA, low probability. Integrate into genes that cause autism, low probability. Integrate into a multitude of the complex genes that cause autism, an even lower probability. So as I sit on study sections at the National Institutes of Health that evaluate the proposed studies that scientists are proposing based on a logic rationale, I would feel that this doesn't meet the qualifications of a logic of rationale that suggests that highly improbable events in total would mean that the DNA would have to insert into sufficient number of cells, into sufficient number of the right genes at the right time in order to affect autism. Put this into my analogy. I think the likelihood of this from a genetic standpoint is not zero. But I think the likelihood is about the same likelihood as an asteroid hitting the royal wedding tomorrow. And I really, and I don't mean to be facetious about that, but I really think that these are series of individual events that have extremely low probabilities with extremely low amounts of DNA getting into the appropriate cells to cause autism. I share my the concerns. I acknowledge the fact that the hockey stick analysis is accurate. The increase in autism is a huge concern in the community. It is on the increase. The causes for that are causes for concern. I do not believe, at least from my scientific evaluation of this kind of information, to suggest that this in any way should have an impact on changing policy. Thank you.
To our third testifier, if you could introduce yourself, who you represent, and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Perry Hackett. I'm a professor in the Department of Genetic Cell Biology and Development. I've been a professor at the University of Minnesota for the past 31 years. My degrees are from Stanford and the University of Colorado. My three-year postdoctoral experience before I came here to the University of Minnesota was with J. Michael Bishop and Harold Varmus. They were co-Nobel recipients in 1989 for the work that was done when we were in the lab. Dr. Varmus went on to become head of the National Institutes of Health and Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Institute. He's now head of the National Cancer Institute. Dr. Bishop has just resigned from being the chancellor of the University of California, San Francisco. My research focus has been for the past 20 years on gene therapy and methods of introducing DNA into the animal genomes of mice, fish, dogs, and starting in 2 weeks, human beings. We don't use viruses for this work. We've elected to use DNAs called transposons that are designed by evolution to hop into genomes. It wasn't until last night that I was asked if I wanted to or would be willing to speak to this community. Chris had asked me if I would talk with the Department of Health after the earlier testimony, and I said I'd be glad to get my remarks on and impressions on the materials that she supplied me, which concerned the aspects of getting double-stranded DNA or even single-stranded DNA to incorporate into human genomes to cause autism. And much of, well, I concur with everything Brian said, except for the bottom line. Dr. Van Esch used the word low probability over and over. It's nil probability. All right? Each of the aspects that are required for these problems to occur is far below scientific abilities to detect. Let me be more specific. The amount of DNA that's in these vials and that would be injected into an arm of a child is about a millionfold less than the DNA that the child is going to take sucking from its mother's nipple from the get-go. Each one of us eats billions of times more DNA in a week than occurs in these vaccines. There's an incredible amount of DNA in our environment. The DNA in each one of you will stretch to the sun and back 200 times. Our cells are dying all the time. We have bacterial cells, 10 times as many of them as human cells. They're turning over. All of this DNA gets into our blood system. It's degraded for the most part. So the second issue is the size, and Dr. Van Esch brought this up. The average size is around 35 base pairs. That's way too small to encode anything. But it's way too large to enter cells. It can't do it unless the cells are treated with very special agents to get them in. I know. I've had millions of dollars in research grants to try and get cells to take up therapeutic DNA. And it is damn hard. Close to impossible without incredible interventions. The fourth aspect that has to occur is integration. Our chromosomes are highly resilient to getting DNA into them unless very special agents are used. We use transposable elements. Nature also uses viruses. We heard the discussion on the use of the retroviruses for gene therapy. There was an important aspect left out of this report about the kids who came down with leukemia when treated for X-linked SCID. 5 patients developed childhood leukemias directly from the gene therapy. No doubt about that, out of the first 10. 4 of them were cured completely. Now, these are bubble boys. They're confined bubbles in spacesuits without this type of therapy, and they die at an early age because it's nearly impossible to protect them for their entire lives from any germs that might come about. But what hasn't been told is that another 15 kids have been enrolled in this gene therapy since these cases. All the parents are lining up. Because we understand what was involved. The last 15 have not come down with any leukemias today, because we understand what's involved, and because we understand that these viruses are designed to do just this. But the DNA in the vials is not in that state. Where would the DNA actually go, according to the hypothesis that was presented to me? And the almost certain place it would go is to repetitive elements in our genomes. Our genomes are roughly 50% repeated DNA elements, largely from transposons and viruses that have been invading them for millions and millions, well, hundreds of millions of years. and this is where these recombinations occur. But little bits of DNA, should they even be able to get into the cell, which, as I told you, they can't, would not cause a problem because these repetitive elements are in innocuous places in our genome. If they were in bad places of our genome, we would run into trouble. Now, what I heard then in the discussion was a mixing not of apples and oranges, but it's the equivalent of mixing Jell-O and steak. Viruses and DNA are very different. Viruses may have DNA in them, but the virus itself confers the ability to get into your cells and possibly even to get into your genomes. But that's not what the issue is. And the second thing that I heard that sounded really like a buzzword, which scientists don't like to hear, and you would never see in a grant proposal, I can assure you. I've sat on 30 years worth of panels reviewing grants, is the presence of human fetal cell DNA. The DNA that you had as a fetus is the DNA you have as an adult, with very, very small changes that have occurred during differentiation of certain cells. It's DNA. DNA from an animal, is a mammal, is close to 90%, 95% identical to that found in humans. It turns out that the genome projects have shown there's not that much difference. So where does this leave me? I'm the husband of a retired public health nurse. I'm a father, I'm a grandfather, and I'm an uncle to a nephew who has autism. I too am interested in this, though it's not my specialty. I'm interested in taxpayer dollars being spent for the very best purposes they can be spent for. Everything that I've seen come before me regarding this project would never get funded by a competitive granting agency because the rationale for it is not low probability. It's nil probability.
Okay, we have one more testifier. If you want to come to the table, introduce yourself and who you represent, and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Diane Peterson, and I've been an advocate for safe and effective vaccines for several decades, first at the State Health Department and most recently at the Immunization Action Coalition, which is a national nonprofit organization based in St. Paul. The coalition's primary function is to create and distribute educational materials for health professionals and the public that enhance the delivery of immunization services. I'm not here to critique any of the scientific information presented to you today. I leave that to a rigorous review by scientists. When I was a toddler, and maybe this is true for a few of you, I received my smallpox vaccination and a series of baby shots for diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. In grade school, I was among the first to be able to stand in line for the polio vaccine, delivered on a sugar cube. What great technology that was. Today, my grandchildren are blessed to be able to receive vaccinations against 16 different diseases. And isn't that wonderful? Immunization has been called one of the 10 greatest achievements of the 20th century in improving the health and life expectancy of people living in the U.S. We now have the means to protect our nation's children, adolescents, and adults against terrible diseases that in the past caused great suffering, disability, and premature death. Yet, in many respects, we have become victims of our own success. Without diligent efforts to maintain confidence in our immunization programs and allow easy access to these life-saving, safe, and effective vaccines, the diseases seen 50 years ago will return to the U.S. Many of these, such as measles, are a plane right away, as we only painfully know from the last month. There have been multiple theories of possible links of vaccines to autism that have been proposed in the last 15 years. And many of these theories, most of all of these theories, have been discarded. a study that's going to be published in the May issue of Pediatrics found that while the majority of parents trust their child's physician for advice on immunizations, there were still about a quarter who trusted celebrities for advice on their child's shots. And a study that's going to be published in the May issue of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that in a typical month, about 80% of physicians report at least one vaccine refusal, 8% report refusal for more than 10% of children in their practice, and 90% report at least one request to spread out their vaccines. Each time a theory is proposed that vaccines are somehow linked to autism, the wedge of doubt over vaccine safety is driven more deeply into the minds of parents. Yesterday, I had the privilege of attending a wonderful event coinciding with National Infant Immunization Week that was hosted by the Children's Hospitals of Minnesota. It was a celebration of our achievements in immunization and a reminder of the work that still lies ahead of us. One very brave mom told us of how her precious 15-month-old daughter, who was vaccinated but had an impaired immune system, contracted Hib disease and fought for her life. The mom was outraged that other parents had chosen not to vaccinate their children for Hib and deliberately put her child at risk. Another, a Somali mom of a child with autism, who had been convinced not to give MMR vaccine to her other children, had since learned that they were duped by bad science. She pleaded with us that we help to educate the Somali community of the truth about MMR vaccine and to also help in finding the true causes of autism. In conclusion, I ask the committee members to consider the significant achievements we've made with vaccination and the need to assure continued access to these life-saving vaccines. And I encourage the legislature to support increased funding for research into the true causes of autism. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Members will open it up for questions. I have one right off the bat for Ms. Peterson. I'm wondering what your response or your organization's response is. You know, I have met with constituents, I have a family member, and know several people who undoubtedly have taken their child at various ages, a child that has met their various mile markers and developmental progress the way they're supposed to, go in for a vaccine and would say that their child was injured and was markedly different and never to be the same after that vaccine. There's, you know, some of them, whether it's been autism or other issues that they've developed after that, you know, and on their personal experience and watching that before their very eyes, in my mind, it's hard to refute their opinion that something happened that day that was not compatible with their child and caused an injury from the vaccine. What is the response of your organization to those, you know, there's books written on it, the people that have written about their personal experience and what they've witnessed in their child that was perfectly healthy up until the day they got a vaccine, which undoubtedly creates concern in people's minds, whether they hear this science and want to get into the scientific debate, their own personal experience is compelling to the public and creates a great deal of fear. And I'm wondering, what is the organization or your personal response, however you'd like to address that, to those particular situations and how the public should respond to some of those incidences?
Well, any child injured by any means is certainly a tragedy. I think if there was some association or some coincidental event with receiving the vaccine, that would be studied, and there are numerous scientific studies underway to look at adverse events that occur after vaccination to determine if there was a true cause and effect or if it was just a coincidental event. So I would look to the science. But what you comment on with these anecdotal reports is what usually gets on Oprah and other talk shows, and it's a tragedy, and it does trigger in a lot of people's perceptions that there must have been a cause and a result from that particular event. But I would look to the science before I would be able to comment on that.
Thank you for that. And I have one more question, and then if there's any other members who want to weigh in. And I don't know who the best person is for this, so you can determine. But, you know, based on the combination of testifiers, we've heard about the ability of forgive me if I mess up the terminology, but whether or not the DNA that is used can be carried through and if it's residual or not. Dr. Deischer presented one side of that. It seems as though one of you gentlemen refuted that. I guess what I'm wondering, is that a widespread point of discussion in the scientific community? I've seen other materials that talk about how this DNA, it cannot be separated in the vaccine process. Therefore, it does come along with the vaccine the virus that's injected as a way of being immunized. And so I'm curious, are there studies to see whether or not that DNA is carried forward? It seems to be a point of contention that would be a fairly significant point in the science of this whole issue. Mr. Hackett.
As you probably know, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is a double-stranded molecule that looks like a circular helix. It's made up of building blocks called base pairs, and each base pair is composed of two nucleotides. The only thing you need to know that for the answer to your question is that all scientists who do any type of work with nucleic acids of mammalian cells know that even a single nucleotide cannot be taken up at all efficiently by cells. Only because the nucleotide has a phosphate group on it, and that prohibits it from being taken up into the cell. DNA is a whole string of these nucleotides with phosphate groups on it. Probably this is an evolutionary defense mechanism that's very powerful to keep DNA of any size, including down to its the smallest component of it, out of the cell until that phosphate's been removed. But without the phosphate, then it's just a very elementary building block. So when many of us run all kinds of experiments, and these have been run since, I got started in 1964 on this, you can't get radioactively labeled nucleotides into cells. You can't do it. You have to let them build it up. And this is not a scientific issue. This is a scientific fact.
Okay. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for, and I'm sorry I forget your name, ma'am, from the Department of Health. How many kids have not been vaccinated in Minnesota and around the country recently related to the diseases that may, according to the hypothesis, cause autism? And how much has that increased over the previous period of time?
Ms. Erisman.
Chairman Mack and Representative. The department, when we look at information on conscientious objection or choosing not to vaccinate, we need to look at information that is provided to us from the schools. And as we look at the number of children that, you know, are not vaccinated for certain diseases, we have seen an increase over the last number of years. In the past, we saw perhaps 1 to 2% of children, who weren't vaccinated. And in the last number of years, we've seen that increase. It's still in relatively small numbers. So we're probably looking at, 3%, 3 to 4% that are choosing not to vaccinate at this point. But what's significant about that and what we see with our current measles outbreak is if you have a situation in which you have clustering of individuals who have not vaccinated, that can really contribute to, outbreaks and transmission of disease. And then once disease gains a foothold, then you can continue to see that disease spread into other parts of the community where you may have, you know, just individuals who are not vaccinated. So what we're concerned about is there's a concept in public health called herd immunity. So it's also referred to as community immunity. It has nothing to do with cows, but it has everything to do with the fact that the more people that are protected against the disease, the less likelihood that any individual who is unprotected will come into contact with disease. And so that's the concept that Ms. Peterson was talking about when that mom was concerned that her child had been vaccinated but couldn't develop an immune response. When other people don't vaccinate, that increases the likelihood that that susceptible person will be exposed to disease and develop disease. So that's why we are concerned when we think about rates dropping or when we see rates dropping. Did that answer your question?
It does.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason for my question is wanting to know how many kids exactly, either in our state or in our country, were not vaccinated. Wouldn't that make a good study of kids who are and who aren't? And what the rates of autism disorder would be in both groups.
Yeah, and actually...
Ms. Erisman.
Excuse me. Sorry, Chairman Mack and Representative. That's what was done with these population studies that I referred to, looking at autism in multiple countries. They compared vaccinated individuals and unvaccinated individuals and looked at rates of autism. That's an important component of any type of epidemiologic study is a comparison. So we talk about case control studies. You have the case who has the characteristic of interest and then a control. In this case, it would be vaccinated or unvaccinated or it could be autism or no autism or in a cohort study either way. But you're comparing those two groups and looking at if there's a difference in outcomes, and that's what was done in those studies. So it has been done.
Representative Barrett.
Sure, and thank you very much for that information. It leads to a third question, which is related to the change point analysis of the doctor and how she correlated the specific instance of changes in the makeup of the vaccines with changes in autism rates. And so I'd like to bring that together with your study to see if they link, to see if you're actually studying the kids at the proper time where the change was made from a one type of gene to a human gene in making up the the vaccine.
Ms. Erisman.
Chairman Mack and Representative. I would make two points on that. First of all, you know, as I described earlier, the hockey stick approach is what's called an ecologic analysis. It's looking at the biggest picture, saying, you know, we see this trend in autism, and then we're going to look at a couple of other things that happened in the environment at the same time, and gee, there seems to be a link. That's really the first step. Now, we could look at that same trend in autism, and we could look at cell phone use, for instance, or intake of pizza or any number of things that may not be related. And part of the next steps are the subsequent studies. So one is to look at, you know, is there biologic plausibility? And that's really what I defer to the presenters from the university for. But the issue there is, you know, could this really happen? Is there a biological way that this hypothesis that's been presented could happen? And I think they have clearly said no, they don't see how that can happen based on their understanding of genetics. And so while I think it's an interesting theory, I think that given the opportunity, we could probably present similar data with other things other than just autism that match those change points.
Okay, members, we have three more people who want to comment. We're going to cut it off there, so if we could keep both questions and answers extremely brief. We have just a couple minutes. Representative Franzen.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm so sorry, I forgot your name. But anyway, so I'm just wondering about those children that choose not to vaccinate, the parents that choose not to have their children vaccinated. And you track those children?
Ms. Erisman.
Chairman Mack and Representative, actually, yes and no. The department tracks immunization rates generally within schools and within the state. That's an important thing that we look at to see if we have communities that are at risk for vaccine-preventable diseases. But no, we don't Typically, we don't track to see if John Smith is not vaccinated. The only time that that would come into play is if we had an outbreak in a school. Schools do keep track of children's immunization records. And so if we have an outbreak of measles in a school, we would talk to the school nurse and say, we've got an outbreak of measles. It's important that you identify who your unvaccinated children are, because they need to be notified that they are at risk of these diseases, and they need to be excluded from school for their health and for the health of the other students. So that's the only instance in which that's something that's important to the department, and it's related to our disease prevention outbreak control activities.
Representative Franzen?
Because I'm one of these parents that don't vaccinate their children, and I don't get my information from celebrities either. However, it is one of my concerns, because, you know, I go to the doctor for their appointment and we are shunned because we choose not to, and treated way differently than when I used to vaccinate my children. So that's a concern as well. And then, you know, going to school and having our children, this is the one that's not vaccinated, this is the one that is vaccinated type of thing. So just don't want our children to be labeled differently because they're not vaccinated.
Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know exactly who to address this question to, but it keeps coming to me that if we have what's called an ethical alternative, there's a way to make these vaccines without using the human DNA, and the risk is so great. I just don't understand, as I'm sitting here, why we aren't just using other, whether it's animal DNA or whatever, as a binder. And the other question that keeps coming to my mind is, yes, chickenpox is not pleasant, measles, mumps, rubella, those are serious illnesses, but autism is a lifelong struggle for somebody. And to take that risk, I mean, isn't that risk equally or even greater than measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, and these things? I just don't understand why this isn't as much of a concern to take more seriously.
I don't know who, Ms. Erisman.
Chairman Mack and Representative. Well, a couple of things. First of all, at this point, with the exception of rabies vaccine, there are no other alternative vaccines licensed for use in the United States. And that's why I did make the comment that if Dr. Deischer was successful, developed a vaccine that was licensed, the department would be very happy to be making, you know, that as an option or promoting that vaccine, and it would be promoted or be made available nationally. But just to be clear, there are no other options at this point, with the exception of the rabies vaccine, which is not part of a routine schedule. So I just want to be clear about that. And then I think that probably we're coming at this from two different perspectives, because you're talking about the risk of autism, and I've just presented that really the view of scientists, you know, in the world of public health and in other aspects of science, that there is not an association between autism and vaccination. And so I understand what you're saying is that my son is on the autism spectrum. So, I mean, certainly that's something that we take very seriously, but because there is not a link that's been found, it's not something, you know, that we're focusing on. We're focusing on the very real aspects of measles, mumps, rubella. I mean, and these diseases are not benign. I mean, you know, having 60% of the children who just developed measles recently hospitalized is quite significant. If you think back to rubella in 1964, we had 20,000 cases in the United States. We had mental retardation. We had, you know, autism caused by rubella. I mean, we had many, many problems from these diseases. So I think it's important that although we don't see them now and they seem sort of old news, they were and can still be very, very significant. So I think that's where we're coming at this from different perspectives. So first of all, to clarify that there aren't other vaccine options. And then second, the reason that we're taking measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, all these things so seriously is because they're real diseases that we can prevent with vaccine-preventable disease. And the autism relationship is not one that we see supported in the science.
Okay, and our last question, briefly, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, first of all, I want to thank all of you very much for coming on really short notice. We really appreciate that. We know you have important work that you could be doing elsewhere. My question goes back to Representative Mack's question, I think the term that now I have to use is the biologic plausibility, which the two scientists were talking about. And I think what Representative Mack was getting to, and if she wasn't, I want to get to it, is sort of here we have three scientists, basically, Dr. Deischer, Dr. Van Ness, and Dr. Hackett. And so we're hearing from three of you, and she's saying that there's a biologic plausibility, and two of you are saying that there absolutely is not. And so what I want you to maybe explain is all we see is the three people sitting here, so it looks like 2-1, but I don't think that's the way it really is. So I think what we need to... What I'd like you to tell us is, you know, where the weight of the scientific understanding is, or the weight of opinion, if opinion's even the right word, about this, and just give us a better perspective on that, if you would.
Dr. Van Ness.
Yeah, I think you probably raised the issue before, and that is the gold standard of acceptance of scientific hypothesis is the peer review of other scientists. I will grant you that you have two people here who are skeptical on Dr. Deischer's hypothesis. I would argue that position that is being taken by Dr. Deischer would be significantly strengthened by a peer review publication which you had asked for. There is none available at this point. So I think that the answer to your question is there is a peer review process of scientists well beyond the two of us sitting here that I think should come to bear on a burden of proof that is required to have any impact on changing a policy on an immunization that is known to have an impact on preventing known diseases.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, very much. And I just want to follow up real quickly because Representative Lohmer was asking about sort of the impact. I know she's not listening right now, but Representative Lohmer, I wanted to get her attention, but, you know, we had talked in a previous hearing when we were talking about abortion policy, and I had mentioned somebody close to me had aborted a fetus late term because of an anomaly, and I just wanted to point out that was caused by exposure to rubella. In a previous hearing, Representative Lohmer, when I talked about someone close to me who had a late term abortion because of a very serious fetal anomaly caused that she discovered, a very wanted child, that was because of exposure to rubella. So that's just an example that this really is a very, and that was within the last 10 years. This is a really serious thing. The really serious things that occur to people that we know about versus what was called, something equivalent to an asteroid hitting the royal wedding. So I just think that's really important to keep in mind.
Very good. Thank you very much to all of the speakers and testifiers and to the committee for a good discussion. Moving on, we have House File 1584, Representative Dean. I will move that House File 1584 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Audience, if we could have enough quiet so we can hear the bill.
More time tonight.
Appreciate you all coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Dean, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you is House File 1584 that deals with the Health Care Access Fund and the 2% provider tax associated with the Health Care Access Fund, and looks at long-term. What are we going to do with this fund? What are we going to do with Minnesota Care? How do we move forward with this? It's similar bills that we have had seen in the past and in the legislature, and I think it's important to take a look at it this year, particularly with the federal health care bills moving forward, and for long-term, what's going to happen to Minnesota Care? You might say, well,
if I could interrupt you just for a moment. We learned this last night, and I've had a conversation with a few of you about it, but it has turned out to be better to hand out an oral amendment and rather than try to lace it together. Yes, Representative Hosh is laughing about that too. So we have before us a piece of paper that's titled the A1. This is being offered as an oral amendment by Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Dean should have to sing the amendment since it's an oral amendment.
Do we have notes? I think Representative Murphy suggested that you sing it, Representative Dean, but perhaps you could walk us through your oral amendment.
I think it would be better for everybody if I didn't do that. Mr. Chairman and members, perhaps Mr. Chung could go over the technical differences with this, since he put this together, caught a mistake in the bill, and was nice enough to put together an amendment for me to get ready for it, so he could probably explain it better than me.
Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment just corrects the drafting error in the bill related to the method by which the commissioner determines whether or not there should be a rate reduction. The old language just really didn't work.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chun. So I'll move your oral amendment, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the amendment is adopted, and to your bill as amended, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a very, very simple bill, and what it says is that each July 1st, the commissioner of the department gets together with MMB. They look at the health care access fund for the upcoming year starting in January, and if there's a 25% cushion in the anticipated funds, the rate of the health care tax, which is currently at 2%, could be adjusted for the upcoming year. That is, you might say, well, why would you even start thinking about that? Because our health care access fund is going to go into the negative very, very soon, because we're being hit very hard in the upcoming 12 to 15 months, and why would we even think about that? And the answer to that is, if indeed the federal bill goes into effect and we see lots of folks migrating from Minnesota Care to Medicaid situation, we're going to see the number of folks within Minnesota Care decreasing, and actually these funds accumulating within the health care access fund very, very quickly, and would address that. And also, I think more, just as and perhaps more importantly, carry on the discussion of what is going to happen with our Minnesota 2% tax, what is going to happen with Minnesota Care, and keep that discussion moving forward. So that's why I thought it was important to continue that debate and indeed to introduce it into a bill form. And I thank you for the committee's time at such a late date to do so.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Discussion to the bill, Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would support this, and I will say it seems like it's contingent upon the early MA continuing. In addition to that, I would say that the tax will probably go to zero in 2014 when the Affordable Care Law is implemented. We will no longer need Minnesota Care. So there's a 2% saving to everybody in the state that buys health care.
Representative Dean?
Well, we don't know where that goes. But certainly,
it's up to us.
Certainly is an important discussion that I think needs to probably carry forward, and so that's why I wanted to introduce it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Barrett and then Representative Vabler.
Sure. Just to the point made by Representative Huntley, is there a federal fiscal note available for that Affordable Care Act?
Representative Huntley. From the congressional, Mr. Chair, and Representative Barrett, there is a fiscal note not directly related to this state, but the cost of the Affordable Care Law has been determined by the Congressional Budget Office to actually save money.
I'm sure we could have a long discussion of this, members, because I happen to know there's a different analysis of that same report, but Representative Vabler.
We're not going there, I don't think. And just to be honest, get rid of the sick tax, finally. I know Representative Huntley has worked on that for a long time, and it's been good to use it for a purpose in the meantime. There was a question about if this has to go to the Health Finance Committee. It does not. It's hypothetical, and there's no impact on the current biennium. So I think it's a good bill. I hope we pass it.
Very good. Members, further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 1584, as amended, is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for your time today and for all your good work this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, we are adjourned.